Hi, I'm Neil Anderson, and welcome to Ungagged Interviews. Tonight, I'm going to be speaking with Graham Campbell and Laura Bilton. We'll find out who they are and what they're about once we hear from Ewan Fox with Dirty Little Damsel. This evening, I'm talking to Graham Campbell and Laura Bilton. I'm going to ask both of them to tell you a little bit about themselves. Graham, do you want to start?
Well, I'll start by saying I'm a member of the SNP NEC. I'm the party's national BAME convener. I am a Glasgow City Councillor and for Springburn, and I'm also a member of the BLM Scotland Collective.
Laura?
I'm also a member of the BLM Scotland Collective, but I'm a long-term anti-racism campaigner, equalities rep for Unite, and I also work in a disability field, so I work with disabled people as well.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Both got excellent credentials. I'm a strong trade unionist myself, so I'm very glad to hear about the Unite connection in there. That's great. So, several things we're going to talk about, but first of all, we'll just maybe do a slight aside and speak to Graham directly. There was a conference just last weekend there for RIC, which has it been revived, or has it just been continuing and wasn't making so many headlines?
Essentially, the Radical Independence Conference is what RIC is. Was began at the time of the the IDRF won, and it made a quite important contribution in having a sort of left perspective represented within the campaigns and arguments for independence. So becoming a very clear socialist, anti-imperialist, pro-environment, pro-workers' rights and anti-austerity perspective was really important in the last referendum. And RIC was a coalition of activists from various socialist backgrounds, Green, Labour and SNP, all in the one place. Also many non-aligned activists, but who support independence. So it was a really important place for that dialogue between different parts of the left from the different traditions, black, white, yellow and green, as I tend to call them. Different versions of socialism, if you like. They had a place to talk to each other and work together. Unfortunately, the people who started it decided that once the democracy of it got going and it was beyond their control, they decided to stop it happening and tried their very best to kill it off. And what Saturday represents is the successful revival of it based on some local groups that continued working over this last few years as RIC went into a bit of a quiet period. But the need, as we know, there's going to be another referendum coming. IndyRef2 requires a RIC2, and this is RIC2, rebooted, reloaded, fresh, ready, the campaign ahead.
Can you tell us a bit more about what happened at the conference on Saturday?
Well, it was organised into a number of sessions, obviously, as these things are. It was organised on the Hopin platform, which was quite famously used for SNP conferences during this lockdown period. And it was an interesting place where you were able to meet activists in a one-to-one blether if you wanted to do that, but also to go to various sessions and come in and out of sessions. And usually when these conferences happen in the real world, it's almost impossible to do that. But actually, that allows you to really properly take part and have more equality within the speakers. You don't have so much top table speaking, you have more grassroots delegates speaking. So the platform really helped to make it much more participatory. I think a couple of hundred people were involved. There was Greens there, SNP there, Socialists, Radical Revolutionaries, you know, you name it, they were there. But there were also sessions with speeches from anti-nuclear campaigners. I was in a session with them, with somebody from the ICAN network, which is against nuclear weapons. I was in another session with an Extinction Rebellion activist who made a really important contribution. So it was a really interesting mix of activists coming from a different place within the wider independent spectrum and different reasons for wanting radical change in this country. And I think what we came to is a really good comradely feeling and a good sort of grounding for how we will rebuild this movement and how we will work in the referendum ahead. We want to build something from the bottom up, which is cross-party, multi-party, non-party, but which is clearly radical and left, and is not simply satisfied with just building an independent country. We want that, but we want to make sure that radical change comes with it. It's not satisfactory to us to simply change the flag without changing the way the state works and the way the country and society is organized. And we were able to get a lot of perspectives around just transition, around what we'll do with COP26, direct action questions of what kind of mobilizing we do. We also talked about the rights of workers and young people and how those rights need to be fought for in the process of the campaign for independence. And I added my bit, which was to talk about BME communities and how BME communities need to be centrally involved and an anti-racist message centrally involved in the campaign ahead. Now, last time, there were several antis that made up the movement for independence, and they were anti-austerity, anti-nuclear, anti-war, anti-racism was one of those planks. And all these planks and different kind of activists from all those sub-movements came together to create the independence movement. RIC, to some extent, reflected that. But I'm very keen that this time, the RIC must help to, you know, reflect all of those elements, plus the most marginalized people in society, working class Scots, black Scots, LGBTI Scots, disabled Scots, need to be centrally involved in the way this movement is built. Because I think it's important that that movement is built in a way that reflects the country we want to create. And that was a quite common theme across a lot of the conversations during the day. I think that, you know, how we build the movement, how democratic it is, how grassroots controlled, it's not top table led, and it can't be closed down by a leadership. It will be organized locally, and there'll be cooperation within regions and nationally, but there won't be a leadership telling our movement what to do. Rick is going to be a grassroots radical independence movement.
That was excellent, Graham. Thank you. That is a movement that I certainly will be buying into myself. Now, one thing that you particularly mentioned there, and I know that both of you are involved with, is the on the inclusion and the anti-racist side of that, to do with BAME communities, and that both of you are involved in some way with the Black Lives Matter campaign. Laura, for the Black Lives Matter campaign, it's been a big international movement. Are just marked the anniversary of the big start of that with the murder of George Floyd, of course. How do you see Black Lives Matter Scotland relating into what is happening here at the moment and into any wider international movements?
Yeah, as you said, this sort of manifestation of Black Lives Matter Scotland came together last year during lockdown, after we all watched in absolute horror the murder of George Floyd. And it was perhaps being in lockdown in a pandemic without all of our usual trappings to keep us occupied, because, of course, George Floyd was not the first murder by police, and has not been the last by any means necessary. But I think it all hit us in a much more personal and emotional and deep way and profound way than other police violence had hit us. And I think many Black people across the world wanted to get involved to sort of say, we don't accept this. You know, we don't accept this. We're tired of being overly policed. We're tired of violence in our communities. We're tired of minor infringements essentially being death sentences. And even in Scotland, you know, we have our own issues with police violence and police targeting in our communities. And also, I remember my mother, for example, she couldn't sleep after it happened. She said, he could have been my son. So this rise of emotion really went across Scotland at that time. And when we all had this cause, it was very easy to organise and come together. We were all in unison. We had white allies marching with us and saying, I don't agree with this either. You know, I want to know more about racism. I want to know more about racism as a structure. We saw the white community being more engaged in anti-racist work than I've ever seen before, when they wanted to understand that racism and prejudice are different things, and they wanted to understand about white supremacy, and they wanted to understand about what is the difference between being non-racist and being anti-racist. So it really felt like they were listening for the first time in a long time. They were listening to us when we were talking about racist experiences that we've had. So it was easy to organise at that time. However, as things have changed, as lockdown is easing, as we're getting back to more of a normal sort of life, we're finding that it is a bit more difficult to keep people engaged. And also we're seeing that a lot of sort of white Scottish people are actually kind of tired of, you know, anti-racism. Not everybody, of course, that's not the case, but we do see there is a sort of kickback where, you know, people are saying, oh, are we still talking about this? You know, it's been a year of this, not realising that for some people it's been a lifetime of this. So what BLM Scotland did was we wanted to see about how we can organise to really fit with the ideals of Black Lives Matter, because Black Lives Matter gets terrible press, but is actually a peaceful organisation that is not anti-white in any way. It is simply saying we want equality and we want a decent life for Black people. It doesn't really mention white people at all. And I think that's where a lot of people find it quite difficult to understand, because white people are not mentioned, but they assume that it's anti-white. This is completely not the case. So we took the BLM global principles and we edited them to make them more suitable for the Scottish climate. In Scotland, we don't have the same militarised policing, for example. So, and I have to say that in all of the protests that we've organised, the police have not caused us any great problems. They have been quite supportive and they have generally more about protecting than trying to clamp down on any protests. So we changed the principles to match Scotland and Scotland's climate. But we also wanted to make sure, as Graham said earlier, that the most marginalised in the Black community also are highlighted and spotlighted in these principles. So we're talking about women. We're talking about the specific violence that Black men receive. We're talking about disabled Black people who are overrepresented in terms of violence against the police. Black disabled community are more victims of police violence, the biggest victims of police violence. We want to look at LGBT Black people, particularly trans women. One of the founders of BLM was a Black trans woman, and Black trans women experience huge levels of violence. The average life expectancy of a Black trans woman is 35 years old. And that is either through murder or through suicide. It's this really impacts people's life expectancy. So we wanted to make sure that our principles mentioned all these things. We wanted to make sure that our leadership was as much of a gender balance in any gender as much as we could. And it took us quite a long time to figure that out, but we wanted to make sure this is who BLM Scotland is, essentially. And how it fits into independence movements is we want to obviously see more Black people in positions of decision making and authority, but that in itself isn't enough, because the racist structures are still there. The racism still exists within the institutions. So we also want to be saying to institutions, what are you doing that is anti-racist? You know, we're working with other groups to look at racism in schools, which is terrible, absolutely terrible. I don't know of a young person of colour who hasn't experienced racism in school. My children have, my nieces do. It's really, really, really appalling. And yet it's underreported. Teachers don't know what to do about it. I've had to, on nearly every occasion when my child's come home and said, somebody said something to me, the teachers haven't really taken action because they don't know what to do or they don't recognise that it's racism. So we are campaigning with another organisation to have anti-racist training for teachers. And also we want to look at, you know, it's a buzzword right now, decolonizing the curriculum. But what does that actually mean? We want to look at what is Scotland's history in the slave trade? How has it fed into the racism and the structures that we have today? And that's not to make anybody guilty about what's happened in the past. It's so people understand that the life that they live, the life of relative luxury that they live, is actually on the backs of exploitation and violence. And I think it's important that people realise about this. We have tried to engage other organisations to ask them about their anti-racist work. Very recently, we wrote a statement for the Scottish Football Association about Scotland choosing not to kneel, apart from when they were playing England in the football. We don't understand why they have done that. You know, it might be seen as a bit of a performative gesture, but it isn't that. It's really an institution saying, we recognise that there is racism within our structures, and we are going to do something about that. So just saying, oh, we'll only kneel because England is, that kind of, we don't understand that. And we've also tried to engage with Scottish rugby when last year somebody was again talking about kneeling and about BLM, and we wanted to make it clear that it is not Black Lives Matter that started kneeling in football games. It was Colin Kaepernick who started kneeling in football games as a protest and police violence. So it was a thing where we're trying to set the record straight, but we've been finding it very difficult for these organisations to engage with us. So like Graham says, we want to be a force where we are empowering the Black people in Scotland and really trying to build a society that's good for everybody. So I'd say with what we want to do, working with grassroots, you know, positive community work, building links with other activists and other organisations as well. We also spoke at COP26 weekend. We were speaking about climate change. So we're willing to stand with organisations, but we also want to make sure that those organisations are looking at their power and their leadership And are they anti-racist as well? So I think we are just working hard to try and make a Scotland that is fit for everybody.
Thank you very much for that, Laura. Graham, do you have any thoughts on how BLM has been doing in Scotland?
Although there's been a lot of positive response to BLM over the last year, and we've got some positive results in the sense that the Chauvin got prosecuted and is being sentenced. That never happened before. Without the international protests and the ones across America, that wouldn't have happened. Perhaps if we had protested a bit more vigorously here when Sheikh Ubar died, that inquiry might have happened quicker. Maybe with Grenfell, if there'd be more people on the streets. Today's the anniversary of Grenfell, and still that tower is there. Still nothing's happening with cladding and the safety of buildings down south. We need to probably do a bit more protesting here as well. But we live in that context, and we live in a context, of course, where the UK state is showing just how institutionally racist and how much it doesn't give a damn about black people. Relatively speaking, we've got a Scottish state which says that it does care about migrants, refugees, EU migrants, black people's rights, and has made very solid anti-racist gestures and statements. Those are good things. It means that the racist backlash that we've faced hasn't been as severe as elsewhere. But we have had denialism. And the classic Scottish denialism is, we don't really have a problem with racism. And what the Black Lives Matter protests told us a year ago is that actually for young Scots who've grown up here, black Scots, they're telling us that their lives are impacted by institutionalized racism in a way that wasn't really talked about until this movement came about. It's provided the possibility to talk about that, and it's good that we've had the conversations. The next thing is, what do we do about them? How do we change the institutions? How does the education department, for example, in Edinburgh, where Laura is, which just sent out a report, which they commissioned, which gathered evidence of about 70-odd cases, showing that there was a massive problem of institutionalized racism across its schools. Yet the person who wrote the report basically said, there's no institutional racism problem, kind of like the London government just did with the Sewell report. So there is a sort of backlash against anti-racism in the form that we've had it before, an attempt to roll back some of the gains that have been made. So the question then for us as people in Scotland, what kind of anti-racist laws will Scotland have? Because if it thinks that the current laws are sufficient, well, obviously they're wrong if they think that. Now, I know they don't believe that, but what I need from them, and I need what black Scots voters in a referendum will need from them, is, what are you going to do differently? What's in it for black communities? How will Scotland behave differently? What kind of anti-racism will it practice? Will it apologise for slavery? Okay, could do that very easily, and possibly we are closer to that because of the reparative justice journey we've engaged in Glasgow, in Edinburgh, and in the Highlands especially. We've made a lot of progress. It's getting attention, actually, in the Caribbean. I've just been tonight on Twitter with Jamaican politicians and activists who are really impressed by what we're doing. But as far as I'm concerned, we've only done the first step, which is the beginnings of awareness raising and consciousness raising. We still haven't tackled the institutions. And since we as the nationalist movement are in charge of these institutions, it's our responsibility when we ask for people to vote for independence that the change in those institutions will reflect what black people want.
Thinking about that and the visibility of it, and something that Laura mentioned about the sports, we've got Euro 2020 at the moment, and with some of the players in the England team taking the knee, to use the phrase, at the beginning of matches, but the Scotland squad have decided that they're not doing that. But I didn't know that they're going to do it at the match with England, but not with anybody else. That is astounding. That's what would you think to suggest to keep it fresh in everybody and not people say, oh, well, we've tried that, it hasn't worked, we're going to give it up?
If they think that is the only anti-racist gesture that they have to do, then it doesn't matter whether they do it or not. If they think, I've solved racism by getting players to kneel, box ticked, racism finished, then it's pointless. As a gesture, it is useful, but what are they doing in the background? you know, what it's, you know, what are their anti-racist policies? What are their statements? Things like that. What are they actually changing? Are they speaking to their Black players to find out what's happening with them? Are they okay? How has this impacted them? How has this affected them? When, you know, their team has decided not to kneel, what's the impact on that? How is that, you know, impacting their young potential Black Scottish players and their Black Scottish fans? It's important, the kneeling is important, but on its own, it's meaningless. So it needs to be backed up with anti-racist action. I don't know what you think, Graham.
I was looking for Marvin Bartley's statement. If you don't know Marvin Bartley, he's the captain of Livingston Football Club. He's a Black English person. And he is, in fact, the SFA's race equality champion. And he this week has said that he thinks they should be kneeling. And that's the problem here, is that if Scotland's FA had actually had a great track record in anti-racism work by making sure there's more Black coaches, Black managers, Black senior officials in the game, members of the SFA board, which there isn't. So, you know, if they had a great track record in these matters, then they maybe would have a point. The problem is they don't. And although every Premier League club and many of the First Division clubs in Scotland has Black players in them, the conversation has not happened with them. It hasn't at all. This decision about, you know, basically a bunch of white players have that discussion amongst themselves with their white manager, who is considerably less moral authority than the white manager in England, who's actually been a brilliant anti-racist ally. We're only kneeling because we would look stupid if the English players are kneeling and we're standing, you know, with our stand gesture where nobody knows that you're doing it. I looked at the Czech game today and I support the team, of course I do. But, you know, they made no gesture at all about racism. And the Czech team has a player suspended from it for 10 matches right now because of racism on the pitch. It would have been an important gesture to do to those Czech fans at the very least, that is not acceptable in the game there or here. But our SFA is AWOL. Now, tomorrow I'm going to actually speak with one of my contacts with the SFA. I was trying desperately to speak to them before the match, and of course they avoided speaking with me before the match because they didn't want the pressure on us. But they're going to get pressure because, of course, they're going to kneel for England. But they should kneel for Croatia as well. And that's what we're asking for them. It's out of damn respect for all those players. Because think about Colin Kaepernick, who lost his playing career from doing that. You know, it's not a radical thing to put a knee down. It's a showing of respect. You know, wearing a poppy every year on their shirts in November doesn't get old. So why should doing a knee for one season get old? Until racism has disappeared, I think you might have to still do it. Now, today I also saw the sort of early days of GB News, Andrew Neil's channel. And they were reporting on this in the way you would expect. And helpfully, they had a very, you know, young Black presenter saying these unacceptable, bad things, criticising Gareth Southgate for being a hypocrite. That's where they're coming from on this. Gareth Southgate was being criticised on GB News this morning, my first Monday morning, and it was already attacking him for being a hypocrite for complaining about the racists booing the knee takers. You know, they're using a Black woman presenter to do that, so that's where they're coming from. You can see their game here. Use a Black face to speak for white supremacy, and that makes it all right. It makes you racist for criticizing them. You know, that's what their game is.
Another area, of course, in all of this, thinking about the independence and life in general in Scotland is directly with politics and then elections and elected members. We know that we have six BEAM MSPs in the Holyrood Parliament from the recent election, and we've got local council elections coming up next year. Is there things that should be improved or changed, or how can we get more BEAM people elected as MSPs or councillors or in any elected position?
I suppose that was for me.
Yes.
I was one of five BAME candidates for the SNP who were top of their regional lists. Four of them were selected as BAME candidates, and one of them was selected as a disabled members candidate. But five of us were top of our regional lists for the SNP. So nominally winnable seats. However, in the SNP winning all of those seats in the region, the constituency seats, we won no list seats in these areas where Black candidates were standing. So there was myself, Fatima Joji in Aberdeenshire, and Michelle Campbell in West of Scotland, who were the three African candidates who stood in for the SNP. There was also Nadia Kanyange for the Greens. She stood third on the Greens regional list in Glasgow. And then there was third on the regional list for the Tories, is Councillor Bailey Adeyibo, who's Nigerian. And he was selected as the first Glasgow Council up here, just 10 minutes ahead of me 4 years ago. But what we all have in common, and I had a chat with him and also other candidates across the country, we all had problems with accessing the party structures. We all had problems with blockage of, not promoting the list candidates in quite the same way. Obviously, the top candidates, constituency candidates, were very promoted, but actually there was a lack of profile actually by the SNP, particularly of its list candidates. And that definitely, the advantage of doing that, the election had started with literally hundreds of thousands of migrant voters being able to vote in the election for the first time, which is very important for our community, because many people after decades here in Scotland were able to vote in an election for the first time, which is great. But they didn't have anybody easily from their communities to vote for. And I think that maybe we missed a trick by not being a bit more out there heralding that as a good thing. I have to say, though, that my experience as a candidate was that, generally speaking, the population accepted us. We did well. We got the votes. I don't think there was any great, racist backlash or anything from us standing. But the truth is that just having the black faces there doesn't change the system. It's what you actually stand for that matters. And I suppose it does help having people with that lived experience in the parliament now, but they won't have a black lived experience. And that's going to be an important missing ingredient during this period when the referendum is going to be planned. And a black perspective will not be in the parliament. That does disadvantage us, I think. And it will make a difference to how the anti-racism agenda is understood in that parliament.
Well, thank you very much for that, Graham, and thank you for your contributions to both of you. Both been very interesting and informative, and hopefully we'll be speaking to you again sometime soon.
Thank you, Neil.
Thank you.